Today in Studio 360, this song by CeeLo did more to change the music video than any other in this century.
They release this video that's pure typography. It's one blue screen and it's words basically on top of each other and sliding in and out.
Since the late 60s, pop lyrics haven't been known for being, you know, deep. So why are they suddenly the stars of the show? And speaking of pop music and deep, for the last year, we followed along as the indie rocker Mike Doty resolved to write an entire rock opera based on what he calls psychedelic biblical prophecies. Now it's time for the big reveal, the premiere of Revelation.
Write the things you have seen and what is and what will be. Write the things you have seen and what is.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first, can professional designers bring some joy to the most frustrating, annoying moments in daily life? We recently asked you to tell us what terrible thing or place or experience you wanted us to transform into something more joyful. We heard about all kinds of dreadful stuff: airport security lines, winter weather, taxes. Ingrid Fattel is a designer with the big cutting-edge firm IDEO, and she is now back in the studio to announce which terrible, miserable, no good, very bad thing that she and her IDEO team are going to tackle for us and you. Ingrid Fattel, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So what are some of the things or experiences among the hundreds that people submitted? What are the ones that stood out to you?
There were some really interesting patterns in the things that people submitted. One of the patterns that we noticed was places where people feel a kind of lack of control. The dentist's office, elevators, and other places where you're just waiting.
Yeah. So among all these suggestions that people made, was there one experience that kept coming up?
The daily commute. And it manifested in different forms. Some people talked about a driving commute. Some people talked about the subway. Some people talked about trains, bus stops. So there were a number of different ways, but it was by far and away the most mentioned topic.
So people want us to design the entire American transportation system in some new fashion. I don't know if we can do that.
It's a big ask. It is a big ask.
But you took that idea, commuting, and sort of not just a commute, but what are you going to redesign?
One of the things that we like to do when we get faced with a challenge that's that big is we like to look at what is the most acute or extreme moment.
Uh-huh.
So nothing seems quite as acute or painful as that Monday morning commute after you've had a wonderful weekend and you wake up and you go to either get in your car or get on the subway.
Right, because it's that phase change from I'm my own master and can do whatever I want and it's been 48 hours and oh, now here we are on the treadmill again. It does seem kind of expansive and ambitious as a thing for us, you, to take on.
Right. Well, so I think for us, you know, we could look at just the commute itself, or we could look at all the things that are happening around that commute, really look at Monday more generally and try to understand, why do people say things like, I have a case of the Mondays? Why is Monday in general so joyless? And we think there are lots of interesting opportunities that go beyond just that one painful moment in the day.
One of our listeners who told us about her frustration with Mondays is Dorothy Weiss. She lives in Alexandria, Virginia, and let's give her a call.
That sounds great.
Hello.
Hi. Is this Dorothy?
Yes, it is. Is this Kurt?
It is. Hi. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. How about you?
I am well, thank you. And I am here with Ingrid Fattel from the design firm IDEO. And we've got some good news for you. As you requested, Ingrid and her team are going to redesign Mondays.
Oh, awesome. That would be the best. Be
that's
even better
plan.
If they could get rid of it altogether.
Well, that may be beyond their brilliance and our superpowers. But Dorothy, I want to ask you. You wrote to us that there is nothing more joyless for you than riding up to work on Monday mornings in the elevator. What is it that you do for a living that makes you dread Mondays and the elevator so much?
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm self-employed, in part because I just couldn't stand those Monday mornings anymore.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go.
Yeah, actually, I think what I like most is that I no longer have a routine. You know, it used to be you get up, you brush your teeth, you take your shower, you do your hair, you get dressed, you know, and it's all this sort of very routine, and it's really nice now to be able to vary that routine. I don't have to do things in exactly the same order. It's just that lack of every day being the same routine.
Well, Dorothy, you are one of the lucky few. Congratulations for the time being. But maybe there's something Ingrid and her team can take from your experience and apply to the world of ordinary wage slaves. Dorothy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I hope that I can help save Mondays for everybody else. That'd be terrific.
We're off to a
Take
start.
Care.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So for you guys, what is the next step to try to actually figure out, as they say in your world, a deliverable?
So we spend a lot of time talking to people. So we're going to be talking to people, not just people who work in offices, but people who work in all kinds of jobs. We know that people in service industries, for example, who are catering to the Monday rush can experience a Monday crunch as well. And then we're going to be doing some sketches and making some prototypes to test things out with people in the real world before we bring them back and show them to you.
Excellent. I cannot wait to see how this expansive, ambitious, gigantic thing can be addressed. And it's a high degree of difficulty, but I have no doubt that you and the team can come up with something great.
Thanks. We're excited too.
Ingrid Fattel will be back in a few weeks to reveal IDEO's makeover for Mondays. Until then, we'll all just have to keep sucking it up and slogging away.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Just another manic Monday. Wish it was Sunday. That's my Monday.
When you're a hip-hop mogul looking to accessorize your big, swanky house with some blue-chip contemporary paintings, who do you buy? If you're Lucius Lyon, the character played by Terrence Howard in the Fox series Empire, your go-to painter is Kehinde Wiley. A handful of Wiley's paintings hang in the sets for the character's fictional home. Wiley's monumental portraits ooze old-school authority. Not old-school like Grandmaster Flash, old-school like Jacques-Louis David and Peter Paul Rubens, whose 17th and 18th century paintings have inspired the poses and costumes that Wiley uses in his work. When he started making his portraits, Wiley was an artist in residence at the Studio Museum in Harlem.
I was scouting for models in the streets of Harlem. Young men between the ages of 18 and 35. I was very interested in finding people who had a sense of sort of alpha male presence, a sense of charisma and personal style. And I invited them to the studio to have a very classical sitting.
He paints huge canvases with bright, bold colors, magentas, blues, and yellows. Virile young black men strike poses against these ornately patterned backgrounds. Instead of ruffles and velvet, they wear baggy jeans and sneakers. It's like the 18th century gone day glow. It sounds comical at first, but as you look closely, it really starts making sense.
So much of the history of painting is the propaganda of self-aggrandizement.
And so much of this present moment. So some producers at VH1 picked up on that and asked Wiley to paint the portraits of a kind of contemporary royalty.
He say one for the trouble.
Hip-hop royalty.
Come on, girls, let's rock that.
LL Cool J, Grandmaster Flash, Salt-N-Pepa.
Ice-T.
And so much of what I had been known for in some ways was taking the relatively unknown moment, the guy who was minding his own business, trying to get to the subway one day and inviting him to be in a 20-foot grandopulent painting, and that moment of chance becomes heroicized. Whereas in these other paintings, we have people who in many ways are heroes to me and to many other people like me, and I was able to be at the leading edge of that heroicizing moment.
No, it's sort of turning you into your 18th century models, right? I mean, if you know, LL Cool J is the equivalent of General So-and-So of 1760.
Sure.
I visited Kehinde Wiley's studio in Brooklyn back in 2008. It was your standard successful artist space. High ceilings, ratty furniture, piles of magazines and takeout wrappers, paint, brushes, and the work. Giant canvases leaning against the wall, some of them 20 or 25 feet long. So, should we look around at some of these,
sure,
at this work? Talk about it in particular and specific? On that day, Wiley was working on a series called The World Stage, Africa, Lagos, Dakar. He had traveled to Africa and found his models for the paintings there. And he based his subjects' poses on particular public sculptures in African cities. Here we are looking at a picture, a larger-than-life-size portrait of two young men in
Senegal. In this particular painting, you're looking at two young men who were back-to-back with their hands clasped together in the front scene. With their other hands, they're both holding onto a piece of cloth, drawing it tautly.
Blazing reflections of activism's upcoming back.
So there is a specific public sculpture in Senegal on which that pose is based?
Yes, in front of the National Assembly, in fact.
Uh-huh.
In the background, there's the pattern of West African fabric that was sourced from the marketplaces of each of those cities.
They're so beautiful. I mean, all of your work is incredibly beautiful, but the use of these fabrics is really, it's really, really beautifully done. And because it goes, the pattern of the fabric goes in front of them as well as behind them, you're messing with the
foreground
and the...
Yeah, I always had trouble with figure-to-ground relationships in painting. Some of those more romantic portraits that I'd seen as a kid.
Do you remember when you went to museums and first saw Titian or Ang or whomever?
I think my earliest memories were at the Huntington Library.
You grew up in Los Angeles?
Grew up in L.A. And there's a large collection of British portraiture. That was really impactful for me, I think, because of all the pomp and circumstance that was in it. Particularly for me as a sort of young black kid who hadn't really interfaced with something of this type of artifice before. It was just.
I don't think many young white kids have either,
but
I know what you mean. In terms of the grandeur? Yeah.
No, I think in the sense of museum culture.
Right.
By and large, when I went to the great museums of California, there weren't people who happened to look like me.
Yeah.
By and large, I was
the black kid
there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I say that specifically to point to some of the aspects in which race plays into the work that I do now. And it does have to do with presence and non-presence.
Both in the museum and in the work, certainly.
Certainly.
Yeah. The colors of the clothes of the models in these paintings are so intense and virtually day glow.
A lot of that is tweaking it on the computer. All of my work is made from photo.
Uh-huh.
The process is to take the photo first and then to go into Photoshop and begin changing things, taking what would normally have been a red shirt and making it day glow pink, and then going out and trying to source that paint. I love the ability to go through thousands of incarnations at the click of a mouse, and conversely, to be able to take the clothing from one model and simply place them on another and say, well, I like this combo better.
You sort of got the best of both worlds, right? Of this very, very old tradition of painting and, no, let me mix it up in this digital way.
Yeah. I think in painting, one thing that we still have is the trace of human presence, hand to paper. And the more you get away from the traditional forms, the more it only heightens that very essential human element.
Thanks. Appreciate
cool.
it. I spoke with Kehinde Wiley in 2008. He has only become a bigger deal since then. A mid-career retrospective of his work just opened at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. That exhibit runs until the end of May, but you can see a slideshow of Wiley's paintings at our website, studio360.org. Back to the motherland. If you've ever been stumped by a lyric in a piece of pop music, you can find pages and pages of interpretation all over the internet. Just ahead, we try to figure out why lyrics have become such a big deal lately. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. On our Kid Brother podcast, Sideshow, my colleague Sean Ramesvaram shines a light on some of the most holy cow corners of the pop cultural universe. Sometimes it's an interview with an elusive next big thing musician. Other times, Sean lasers in on some unavoidable new trend in internet culture to figure out what's going on. That is the category that our next story falls into, and it starts with a little bit of radio theater.
What you are about to hear is a dramatic reenactment of something that happens in the digital world every day.
You know what song I love right now?
Top 40 stuff?
Oh, yeah. But I think maybe my number one top jam.
Lay it on me.
It's that new Kanye song.
Oh.
You know how it goes?
Only one?
Uh-huh.
Hello, Marvin!
You like that?
Not Marvin.
What?
It's not Marvin.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. I'm totally.
I'm pretty sure it's
I'm being dead serious. It's not Marvin.
No.
I think I know from Genius.
What do you? I think it's a Marvin Gaye reference.
I know from Genius.
What do you? I don't understand the words you're saying right now. You know what? You're genius. A genius.
It is a website, kind of like lyrics.com, except what they do is they annotate all the lyrics in a song, so you can find out exactly what is being said and why it was being said. You ready? You want me to show you? Here's what we got. As I lay me down to sleep, I hear her speak to me. Hello, Mari.
That is, it's Hello, Mari.
Hello, Mari. Now I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to click it. Okay, here we go. Genius annotation. 6 different contributors. Everyone doubts themselves from time to time, even Kanye. Controversy has followed Ye since his mom's passing. From the Taylor Swift incident to run-ins with the paparazzi, Kanye couldn't catch a break. Donda tells him to believe in himself. Something she's told him his whole life. She refers to him as Mari, a shortening of his middle name, Omari. In Swahili, Omari means God the Highest.
Are you kidding me? There's even a picture of him and 2 very beautiful people.
Daughter Northwest.
That's his kid?
It'd be kind of dumb to say that people care about lyrics more now than they used to, but thanks to the internet, we can now sort of measure how much people care, and they really, really care. And they care in a bunch of sort of different remarkable ways. There was this article about the annotated lyrics site Genius in New York Magazine a few weeks ago, and it said that 2% of all searches online are for lyrics. 2% of
all searches.
2% of all web searches explains why there are so many awful, awful sites dedicated to lyrics. You know, Direct Lyrics, AZ Lyrics, Metro Lyrics, Lyrics Freak. The second we could connect to the internet, we wanted to use it to connect to our favorite music. And these sites are here to make money off of that connection by selling us music and ads and ringtones. But in the past few years, that connection we made with music online has actually inspired musicians and artists and fans to get way more creative and even profound about lyrics. In 2010, CeeLo's F*** You was kind of a game changer, not just on account of its funny, profane lyrics, but because of how they were presented. Before he released a traditional music video, CeeLo released a lyric video.
This is before songs were regularly available on streaming services right away.
And this is Kevin O'Keefe. He writes about entertainment and pop culture for The Atlantic.
So the only way it was getting passed around on streaming was people uploading their own lyric videos, basically. They were just ripping the song from iTunes and putting it up.
You've seen these fan-made videos. They're all over YouTube. Picture the lyrics to a song you really like fading in and out slowly over a photo of some stranger's cats. CeeLo and his label wanted to find a way to drive people away from those cats and to drive them to something they could own. And they did.
They release this video that's pure typography. It's one blue screen and it's words appearing basically on top of each other and sliding in and out and everything. It's sort of the form that we know now as the lyric video.
CeeLo wasn't the first person to do this. George Michael and Prince both toyed with the concept in the 80s and early 90s when they just didn't feel like making music videos for their singles. Instead, we got static text and boring backgrounds. And if you want to go way back, there's Bob Dylan's iconic homemade cue card video for Subterranean Homesick Blues. But CeeLo's lyric video for F*** You was a game changer in 2010, and part of that had to do with its title.
It's exuberant about it as it happens. Like, the word F*** You literally just, like, jump onto the screen harder than anything else.
Yeah.
It's really funny that it started with a song that was so perfect for it in a way. And I think without that lyric video, the numbers for the actual video are worse later on. I think the song does not become the massive phenomenon it does where he's singing it with Gwyneth Paltrow at the Grammys in Muppet costumes.
And even bigger than Gwyneth and the Muppets is the tidal wave of lyric videos that followed. Next to everyone makes them now, from Timberlake to Nico Case to your buddy's bluegrass band. And they keep getting better, too. Ariana Grande is actually in a few of her lyric videos, and Katy Perry's lyric video for Roar is this fun, animated text conversation with emojis. Lyric videos are racking up tens and sometimes hundreds of millions of views, but for now, the lyric video is just a useful substitute when a band doesn't want to make a real one. That being said, the lyric video is going to have an influence on music videos. That's already happening. Last week, Run the Jewels released its music video for Lie, Cheat, Steal, and during the hook, you see the lyrics animated all over LP and Killer Mike. Lyric videos are the best when they're your introduction to a song. You get to understand its deep truths that much faster. And if you want to go even deeper, there's Genius.
One of the functions of this site is incredibly simple and useful, which is simply trying to get the lyrics right.
Until recently, Genius was Rap Genius, a site where you could find crowdsourced, annotated lyrics to your favorite rap songs. It was super popular in hip-hop, but also had a reputation for being a giant frat party of a startup based in a few neighboring luxury condos in Brooklyn. But recently, Rap Genius changed its name to Genius. One of the site's infamous founders walked away from the company, and then they went and hired a bona fide genius to help annotate songs.
My name is Sasha Frere Jones. I'm one of the executive editors here at Genius.
You might remember Sasha Frere Jones from The New Yorker, where he wrote about pop music for a decade. He claims to know little to nothing of Genius's past reputation.
There are blueberries in the fridge. Somebody gave me a seltzer. I'm a cheap date. You give me seltzer, I'm good.
Part of Genius 2.0 is blueberries, apparently. Another part is branching out into annotating whatever. State of the Union, Shakespeare, prescription drug bottles. But for now, the site's bread and butter remains song lyrics, from pop to country to rap. And Sasha would argue that this particular part of the site is needed now more than ever.
Now people are being given less and less time to write about stuff. Albums are now dropping out of nowhere. This is like the new fancy car. Like, the way you show that you're an alpha pop performer is you're like, I'm going to put out my album. Nobody's expecting it, you know? Like, it's the new bling.
If there is less time being devoted to real music criticism, it sort of makes sense that a revered pop critic would end up a genius, a place where you can dedicate all the time in the world to figuring out the meaning of some inconsequential couplet. What's funny is that the answer to your burning lyric question might come from a 12-year-old. Take the first line of Blank Space.
Incredible Things is the name of her perfume. And every single person I showed it to, and they are definitely people who like and know Taylor, were like, what? I didn't know that. And I'm like, yep, it's product placement. Literally nobody knew that. I mean, first of all, including me.
It doesn't all end up being revelatory. A lot of the site's annotations are just kind of ridiculous, because a lot of lyrics don't really need annotation. Like this line from Drake's Worst Behavior. I'm glad that they chose us. Command is a mission, try to fight to the finish, just to see my finish. On my worst behavior, no.
This is what I would call a denotative line. That makes sense. It's not got any wordplay or double entendres. He's just saying what he's saying.
But we're, of course, if we click on the annotation, we have like a 3-paragraph essay on what it's like to go on a mission in the military with this photo.
And a JPEG of two guys in camouflage in the forest. You know, we don't want lots of stuff like, J. Cole kills it on this one. It's like, that's not an annotation. That's just what you think.
Sasha's job is to make sure the site offers less of the stuff you'd find in YouTube comments and more hidden meaning. And that's what really drew him to Genius, the chance to celebrate music and lyrics on a scale that's never really even existed before.
For anyone who loves these facts and loves these words, and we're dealing here with production, we're dealing here with culture, we're dealing here with transmission of symbols, and it just feels very helpful. I know that's sort of a watery, not very strong word, but here it is, and now people can run with that.
And it's not just fans running with Genius, it's the artists themselves. Sasha recently interviewed Rick Rubin for a bunch of Beastie Boys and Johnny Cash annotations. Nas has done some stuff via video. And other artists have signed into Genius to annotate songs themselves. Sia is one of them.
I'm going to swing from the chandelier. I've never actually done that, she says, but it sounds fun. That's it. Next line. I'm going to live like tomorrow doesn't exist. I've written this lyric or something like it into at least 40 songs in the last year. A couple more. But I'm holding on for dear life. Won't look down, won't open my eyes. She says, sad. So sad. Next couplet. Keep my glass full until morning light, 'cause I'm just holding on for tonight. Keep my glass full until morning light, 'cause I'm just holding on for tonight. Still sad, she says. Third of four. Help me, I'm holding on for dear life, won't look down, won't open my eyes. She says, very sad. And then the last. Keep my glass full until morning light, 'cause I'm just holding on for tonight, on for tonight, on for tonight. Keep my glass full until morning light, 'cause I'm just holding on for tonight. And she says, pure sadness. Yes, very sad. 'Cause I'm just holding on for tonight, 'cause I'm just
holding on for tonight. That's Sasha Ferrer-Jones talking with Studio 360's Sean Ramosfero. Thanks to Andy Mills and Matt Kilty, our voice actors. You can hear all kinds of other stories like that by subscribing to Sean's podcast at studio360.org/sideshow. Coming up, the indie rocker Mike Doty. For the lyrics to his latest project, he turned to the Bible, the final book of the New Testament. And it's awesome.
Write the things you have seen and what is and will be. Write the things you have seen and what is and will be.
That's still ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Kelly Link is an author who writes some of the most unusual and fetching short stories around right now. The first story in her new collection, Getting Trouble, is called The Summer People. It's about a teenage girl in the rural South whose bootlegging father's just taken off. The girl, Franz, got the flu and is stuck looking after rich people's summer houses, the other part of their family business.
At the convenience, Fran picked up milk, eggs, whole wheat sandwich bread, and cold cuts for the Robertses, Tylenol and more NyQuil for herself, as well as a can of frozen orange juice, microwave burritos, and Pop-Tarts. On the tab, she told Andy. I hear your pappy got himself into trouble the other night, Andy said. That's so, Fran said. He went down to Florida yesterday morning. He said he needs to get right with God. God ain't who your pappy needs to get on his good side.
So far, we could be in Dorothy Allison or Bobby Ann Mason territory. But then something strange happens. We learn that one of those houses she has to take care of is enchanted in some way, a fairy house. The summer people aren't quite human, and they don't pay Fran and her family in money.
Here, Fran said, I brought this back down. My iPod, Ophelia said. She turned it over. They did this? The iPod was heavier now. It had a little walnut case instead of pink silicone, and there was a figure inlaid in ebony and gilt. A dragonfly. A snake doctor, Fran said. That's what my daddy calls him. They did this for me? They'd embellish a bedazzled jean jacket if you left it there, Fran said. No lie. They can't stand to leave a thing alone.
And that is Kelly Link's signature move. Everything seems mundane and believably boring, but then it turns out to be supernatural and usually dangerous. Get in Trouble is her fourth collection of stories, and she joins me here now. Hello, Kelly Link.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So you've got one of those names that is fun to say. I'm sure your friends probably call you Kelly Link.
Actually, growing up, my friends called me Smelly Stink.
But you've gotten back at them now. I mentioned the great story, The Summer People, which starts the collection. When you wrote that and when you write a story like that, do you start with a realistic story notion about people and their messed up lives and then see where that leads you? Or did you imagine this particular magical house and its particular inhabitants and then see how that could become the center of a story?
I imagined the second. I imagined the house first, and I imagined it in a place where you wouldn't necessarily expect a fantasy fairy house to be, which was the Appalachian Mountains. And once I had that, then I could start thinking about the kind of people who could be in that story.
You've talked about reading Tolkien as a child, as did I, as did plenty of other writers. When did you know that you didn't have to give this up and this would be your path?
Well, I went through an MFA program at the same time that I began working in a children's bookstore. And while I was writing stories for the workshop, I was also rereading a lot of classic children's fantasy. And I ended up writing stories that had a lot of fantastic components.
Really?
And they were basically fantasy. And, you know, I wrote them and I turned them in and nobody said, you can't do that.
I was going to ask. I mean, in an MFA program where everybody's trying to be a serious writer with only the pretentiousness of 23-year-olds, they didn't sort of put you down?
They did not recoil in horror. I think they maybe were a little perplexed, but they treated me gently and nobody told me to stop doing it.
I think you were probably lucky to come along when you did. If you were just even 10 or 15 years older, it would have been a harder row.
I think absolutely. But I'm also left-handed. So, you know, 50 years ago, I would have had to learn
to
write right-handed.
Me too. You are, it seems to me, having read this book of stories, both a realist and a fantasist. Therefore, I wondered, you must have twice the influences of other writers. So, first of all, who are your realist, biggest realist influences?
Well, I really love Grace Paley. Absolutely love Grace Paley. Eudora Welty, big fan of her work. I love Laurie Colvin.
Yeah. And then on the fantasy side?
Tons and tons. You know, M.R. James, Lovecraft even, Ursula Le Guin, Peter Straub.
What? Lovecraft in particular seems to be within this great, you know, revival moment of fantasy, seems to be having his own special revival. Why is that?
I don't know. I you know, he's kind of a singular prose stylist who's not going to beat everybody's taste.
My new
husband, you know, had to read some Lovecraft for a review he was writing, and he got through 1.5 stories, and he kept on saying to me, do I have to read more? Does it get better?
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's probably not going to get better for you.
Yeah. And when you describe the prose style that's not for everybody, what is peculiar about it?
Well, you know, he's very atmospheric, a lot of descriptions of things in which basically he's telling you he can't possibly describe them because they're so terrible. It's a writer named Jack Womack who says that Lovecraft boils down to ands and ands of unspeakable evil.
You grew up in Florida. Did that shape you as a writer, do you think?
Probably. I grew up reading, you know, Dave Barry in the paper.
Well, there you go.
Carl Hiaasen mysteries for, you know, the guy with the Roto-Rooter for an arm. It is a place that has a really peculiar, lively environment. You know, there are always things coming in the house. You know, I think the first night that we spent in our house in Florida, you know, a cloud of 2,000 mosquitoes flew down the chimney, which my parents discovered because they were being bitten. They walked out in the living room and they could see this silvery cloud coming. And, you know, why is there a fireplace in Florida, for one thing?
In your real life, in your heart of hearts, how much of a rationalist are you? And how much do you believe in spooky, magical, supernatural things?
You know, I've never had anything spooky happen to me. But I'm always happy when someone I know has a ghost story or tells me about something weird that happened. I am absolutely willing to believe that what they're telling me.
It's not as though that's amusing, but I don't really believe it. You actually believe it.
Well, you know, it's a great thing when somebody else tells you a story. You think, well, who can say? But that was a great story.
Yeah. You have talked about reading a lot of fan fiction. And I don't think I've ever heard a professional writer say such a thing. Why do you do it?
Well, I mean, I think it tells you a lot what story makes people want. I mean, you know, these are people often who are deeply attached, as I often am, to particular books. And then when they go off and write, the reason why they're writing is they want to see those characters happy. They want to see them, you know, eating dinner together and going to see movies and maybe painting each other's toenails and having sex. They just want to have them have some joy. And it's not that I go off and I think, well, I'm going to write a story where everybody's happy. But I think I want to write stories in which people feel this attachment to the characters in which they think,
I want to make their life
happy
nice
for a while. Yeah. I mean, that's an understandable impulse.
Yeah.
You love characters so much, you think, I just wish they could be happy.
Yeah. There's a story in this collection about two guys having a baby with a surrogate mother whose pregnancy gets complicated and terrifying. It's a classic short story with nothing really supernatural that happens. Tell me about that and why you put it in the book. It seems like kind of an outlier.
Well, I did want one thing in there that felt different from the other stories. A lot of it pulls from the lives of my husband and myself. We had a daughter at 24 weeks, and we spent a lot of time in hospitals with her. And she's 6 now. She's in great shape. But there was sort of a feeling of suspended time and suspension in which everything that happened seemed enormous and momentous. And yet everything was moving really slowly. We couldn't take her home. Took her home for a day. She had to go right back into the hospital. We spent another half a year in hospital after that. And so I wanted a story which would sort of capture that feeling where you think, I'm never going to get out of this place. And yet the best thing in the world has just happened.
As I was reading that story and waiting for whatever terrible thing is going to happen, and by the way, listeners, it ends okay. But I realized that actually pregnancy and childbirth and child creation is the closest thing to supernatural fantasy in our real lives, in my real life anyway.
Absolutely. Suddenly there is a person who was not there previously.
Yeah. And that you've made in this crazy way that makes no sort of normal sense.
No. In fact, you know, didn't it take people hundreds of years to figure out that's where they were coming from?
Yeah. They're like, did it?
I think so.
Really? That one was a straightforward, realistic story. Do you want to do more of that kind of writing?
You know, the next thing I have to work on is a novel in which I plan to cram in as much fantasy as possible, as much weird stuff as possible. But I did like writing that story.
Yeah, you said you have to write a novel. You've published 4 books of stories, been writing for 20-odd years, I guess. How come you haven't written a novel yet?
You know, I didn't really want to. I really love short stories. And then In the last 5 or 6 years, the stories that I've been writing have gotten longer and longer. And a very good friend who's, you know, smart about this stuff said to me, they're getting longer because you should write a novel now. And I thought about it and I thought, that seems right. I think I should probably see how far I could push it, you know, if I can make something even longer.
And I read somewhere that your publisher really wants you to write a novel as well.
Well, you know, this is the thing about writing short stories is you write short stories and people say, we really, really like these stories. Are you going to write a novel? And I don't know why, but I think maybe after 20 years of hearing that, you think, well, okay, well, maybe I should write a novel. That sounds like fun. And I often go and work in cafes or in other people's houses, and the people that I work with are, for the most part, novelists. So I have some expert, you know, problem solvers that I can, if I get stuck.
For the books you publish?
No. When I write, I'm usually writing with other people, two or three other people.
With, in what sense? Literally sitting
we're
in a room?
Sitting in a room or in a cafe.
What? Why?
It's companionable. You know, we all feel happier knowing that somebody else is suffering alongside with us. No, it doesn't sound good to you.
No, I feel far more when I'm writing. I need to be alone far more than I do when I'm using the bathroom or something. I need to be locked in privately. Yeah.
Well, you know, and I recognize that that's true. But I actually, when I was working on my own, I was miserable. I gave up a lot. Once I started working with other people.
Huh.
I actually thought, well, this seems much more possible than it did previously.
Well, it's working for you.
It does seem to be.
And best of luck with it.
Well, thank you.
Kelly Link's new book is called Get in Trouble, and it's out right now. At the end of every year, we ask you to send us your creative resolutions for the new year, projects you've always wanted to do but needed a little push to get going. Then we follow a handful of you and try to encourage, pester, and if necessary, humiliate you into doing them. A year ago, we got one of our most peculiar and ambitious proposals yet. The musician Mike Doty, whom you might recognize from the great 90s band Soul Coughing, wanted to write a rock opera based on the Book of Revelation. How could we say no to that? Mike followed through, met his deadline, and premiered his show in 3 performances at WNYC's Green Space in New York. And I gotta tell you, it was amazing. I can honestly say I never thought Revelation could be made into a musical that actually rocked. Mike and I talked about it in front of the live audience at the final show. So you said, okay, I heard this guy on the radio say we want New Year's resolutions. You decided that I was the voice of God telling you to do this.
Yes, I did, yeah.
And you've been thinking about this for a while?
For a decade, if not more. I've been sort of salting stuff from Revelation through work of mine, you know, for as long as I've been writing songs. But I had just bought 5 translations, like days before I heard the New Year's resolution thing. And I said, okay, this year I'm going to do something. I'm going to write an outline. I'm going to do something. So I got the King James and the CEV and the ESV and just sort of all these sort of modern and semi-modern translations, and had once again collapsed in despair when I heard you guys, and I was like, these people can yell at me and I might actually do this.
Yes.
So that it was perfectly timed.
Whosoever loves and makes a lie, whosoever loves and makes a lie, I, whosoever loves and makes a lie, whosoever loves and makes a lie.
Then the angel said to me,
come with me, and I will show you the bride of the word.
So I was taken in the spirit to a mountain. I was shown the new city descending out of heaven from the word. I saw no temple in the city, for the word itself is its temple. And the gates are never shut, for there is no night there, and there is no need for the sun nor the moon, for the word is its light.
I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand.
And the angel showed me a river of life proceeding from the throne of the Word. On each bank grew a tree bearing 12 kinds of fruit and leaves to use for the healing of the nation. And when I had heard and seen, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel who showed these things to me. But he said,
worship me not, for I am but your fellow servant. Worship only the Word.
I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand. I come quickly, for the time is at hand.
I testify to everyone that hears this. If anyone adds to the words of this book, or if anyone should take away from the words of this book, the word shall take their part out of the book of life and add them to the plagues written herein.
Let anyone who would hear this come. Let anyone who is thirsty come. Let them drink freely from the river of life. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. He who is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he who is righteous, let him be righteous still. Those who wash their robes will be permitted to enter through the gates of the city. And outside the city are dogs, and sorcerers, and murderers, and idolaters, and whosoever loves and makes a lie.
Whosoever loves and makes a lie, 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 whosoever loves and makes a lie. Whosoever loves and makes a lie.
On the drums, Pete Wilhoit. On the vocal, Amber Gray. On the trumpet and the keyboard, John Gary. On the vocal, Senia Rubinos. On the cello, Andrew Howard Livingston. On the vocal, Melissa McMillan. And on the visuals, Zebediah Keneally.
And you can see that animation that accompanies Mike Doty's revelation in a video at our website, studio360.org. While you're there, you can also download a podcast of the full 90-minute performance of Revelation, and trust me, it's worth a listen. And that's it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Special thanks this week to Jennifer Sendro, Ricardo Fernandez, Chase Colpan, and everybody at the Green Space. Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegen. And before I leave you, last weekend we watched the Oscars, and we invited all of you to join us online during the broadcast to play Awards Night Bingo. We want to thank everybody who played along, especially the people who tweeted their winning bingo cards. They are Jason, Babette, Annabelle, Brooke, Rachel, Ashley, Angelica, Chris, Leslie, Sarah, Donna, Michael, Colleen, Sue, Jake, Catherine, Mind as Water, Belle Goble, Jeremy, Janice, Lynn, Christoph, Robert, and Stephanie. Thank you, everybody.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a new show dives headfirst into some of the most explosive issues facing our society.
It just figures my son goes off to another country to fight. Then he comes home to America and he gets killed by somebody from another country.
The Oscar-winning creator of the new TV show American Crime, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.